taken under advisement. The next case for this morning is United States versus Randall Moss et al. Mr. Handel?
Please court, Robert Handelsman for appellant Randall Moss. This morning I'll be speaking to argument one of the reply brief. The two out-of-circuit cases cited by the government, Chase and Diaz, both decided after the initial brief was filed. If followed, will essentially hold for naught the rule that a sentence cannot exceed the statutory maximum. These two cases allow the government to request a sentence exceeding the statutory maximum for the amount involved in a drug conspiracy simply by adding the amounts involved in the substantive counts to the amount involved in the conspiracy, even though the sentence for the conspiracy includes the amounts involved in the substantive counts.
But the conspiracy offense is a different offense. We've held in a number of cases that you can have consecutive sentences if one counts conspiracy and one substantive.
That's true. But what is the basis for a sentence in a drug case? Is it the way it was done here was the basis for the enhancements. But it's always been the statutory maximum for the amount involved in the conspiracy, which is usually the highest amount. I mean, the government here mislabeled the indictment. If they had put in 50 grams instead of 5, there would have been an Anders brief for Moss. But they made it 5 grams, where the statutory maximum is 40 years. He didn't get 40 years for that statutory maximum. He got 80.
But and the thing is, the offense in the conspiracy count is the agreement to do something unlawful. And it's true, the sentencing guidelines measure the culpability of that agreement by how much of the drug is being distributed, but it's, you know, we could get into a long debate about the, you know, how far conspiracy offenses may go, but the fact is they're separate offenses, and that's established. And we measure the culpability of distribution offenses also by the amounts involved. And I understand what you're saying about being, let's say, the same sales being used, but they are two separate offenses. It seems to me your argument would pretty much repeal 841.
No, I don't think so. What we're asking for here, what we're suggesting here, is that when you look at a total quantity, There has to be some limit on the sentence, because if a defendant theoretically is charged with 1,000 grams and then 1,000 substitute counts of selling 1 gram each, or as I mentioned in the reply brief, of 1,000 grams of possession of intent to distribute, he's essentially being sentenced on the basis of 2,000 grams, even though the agreement, which is what you mentioned, is 1,000 grams. In this case, as far as the indictment and special verdict are concerned, the agreement is 5 grams, which carries a maximum sentence of 40 years. And that should be the limit of the stacking. Sentences can be stacked to the statutory maximum, as you phrased it, to the extent of the agreement, which was 5 grams here.
But you're saying that you can't have ever a consecutive sentence for a substantive count unless it's somehow outside the scope of the agreement.
No. You could have a sentence, but it has to be limited to the amount of the whole agreement, which here is 5 grams.
Well, but that does eliminate the possibility of consecutive sentences, because if you conspired to distribute 5 grams, you've agreed that's a separate offense from the actual substantive distribution of the 5 grams. And right now, we have understood the law to permit consecutive sentences for that if under 5G that's necessary to achieve the guideline sentence.
Well, this comes back to the question of Apprendi. Because if the statutory maximum is going to have a meaning, there has to be a limit to the concept of stacking. Or else you can have an agreement for 5 grams, as you did here, and you can have a sentence that goes on into infinity based on a gun, a minor, abuse of trust, obstruction, anything else. I mean, does the term sentence of statutory maximum have any meaning anymore? Now, the Apprendi opinion says it's based on the Constitution, and it has to outweigh 5G 1.2D. There is a tension between the practical effects. I know you have cases saying Apprendi has nothing to do with the guidelines. But when it comes to stacking, it has everything to do with the guidelines. Because this is just a convenient way for the government to avoid Apprendi. Well, we'll just stack up the sentences here.
Well, they do have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt more than one count before that can happen, right?
Yes, they do.
So that's at least something. It seems to me, you know, the watershed decision is to decide that the way Apprendi operates is to permit consecutive sentencing. So if you have a 3-count complaint, it's, let's say even it's 20 times 3, if you're down to the smaller default statutory maximum. So that's 60. Now, that's a step we've taken. You're free to argue it was wrong, but if you can do that, then what does, you may be right that Apprendi doesn't mean a whole lot.
Well, it certainly didn't in this case. And that's why I suggest that there has to be some limit on what the government can stack, and it should be the statute. It should be the statutory max for the amount of the agreement here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Covelli.
May I please this honorable court? Carl Clavelli on behalf of Mr. Brad Taylor. Your Honor, we've presented 3 arguments in our brief. The first argument talks about the introduction of evidence against Mr. Taylor, which should not have been entered at his trial, particularly in the direct examination of the government's witnesses. 3 of the witnesses testified that they had been incarcerated in various jails with Mr. Taylor. The purpose of this testimony was to indicate that there was no defense, that the witnesses were not afraid to say to Mr. Taylor, well, I'm going to testify against you, and to sort of take the jury's mind off the government's burden of proof in this case, and to center it instead on, well, yes, this gentleman was a user, which apparently the witnesses put in. Well, I'm only a user. Everyone knows I'm not a dealer. But, of course, the witnesses all were saying, I purchased from him. I saw him cutting up dope. He was a member of the conspiracy. Then the last witness was the case agent who picked up where these first 3 witnesses left off and said that, yes, you know, the evidence was so strong from all of the witnesses that we had. All the people corroborated each other. He mentions the post-arrest statement of Randy Moss at least twice, saying it was so strong, and he implicated Mr. Taylor. The same testimony that was the purpose of the severance of the case. And the case agent also introduced his opinion that the evidence was so strong, which is also a violation of due process in this case. So,
well, on the jailhouse people, I mean, the government argues that there's really no evidence that it deliberately elicited, that these informants deliberately elicited the statements from Mr. Taylor, and he was just going around talking to people.
I understand, Judge. The only thing I can say, because there was no hearing, as there should have been, in the district court, and I believe the court, the remedy here is that the court should send it back for that hearing. But in this case, we actually have three witnesses who do have plea agreements. They are in these small county jails. This court has mentioned in the past, you know, when we start putting people, isolating them in county jails where there's a few other federal prisoners, and they're on the same case. This is not even a situation where they're known to each other and they're on different cases. They're actually on the same case. I think two of the three were actually co-conspirators. And I just feel there's something wrong about the defendant having to ride the court with the co-conspirator who's going to testify against them and ends up having...
Do you want some rule that they become agents of the government then once they sign a plea agreement?
Well...
Something that's said to them is said to them as an agent of the government.
I just think happening three times in one case is at least two more times than should have happened. And I can't understand why the information would have been brought out on direct examination if it wasn't to prejudice the defendant.
I suppose it depends where you start, but I had exactly the same concern Judge Evans was just talking about. Yes, there's a plea agreement, but you need to show that they're actually acting as a government agent, and I think to take the jump from plea agreement to agency is a pretty big step.
Well, there is a case called Maine versus Moulton where the person who was accused of being a government informant passively listened to what was being done. That was because, in my opinion, it was pretty well known that this person would have access to the defendant, and in that case, the Supreme Court was unwilling to say this is a mere accident waiting to happen. I do believe there is a burden on the prosecution in this case to be more fair to the defendant, and that the defendant was deprived of a fair trial because of all this evidence that came in that just should not have come in.
Even if that evidence hadn't come in, though, what difference would it have made? I mean, I take it you think that if he'd driven in a separate car to and from the courthouse, everything would have been fine?
Well, it would have helped, but the record is not really clear on what portions came from being in the car and what portions came from being in the jail. Your Honor, there was only one actual sale charged in this case against Brad Taylor, and that sale was highly contested because the confirming tape was very bad. And, of course, one of the witnesses specifically said, well, he's going to rely on the poor quality of the tape. And the government basically argued, well, you know, he's reduced to relying on our evidence not being strong enough, but our evidence is undisputed. So there was this element of if he was a member of the conspiracy, why isn't there more evidence that he's selling drugs? He's there every day. And only one witness said he sold a few times where the government wasn't present watching. But in the one case where the government has a person wired, that case is not really clear who the seller was. The defense position was it was Eric Moss. So, Your Honor, while the evidence was sufficient, there's no doubt that it was, the defendant really didn't get a fair trial by having all this other extraneous evidence coming in. And then on the sentencing, if I may just add briefly, he was the only witness, he was the only of the three defendants, Billy Taylor particularly I'm focusing on, why wasn't Billy Taylor's sentence 1 ounce of crack a week, 1 ounce of powder a week? It was not. And if it was, he would have been in Category 38, but he was in Category 30, offense level 32 based on drugs, and only went up to 34 because he had an obstruction of justice. So Mr. Taylor should have been at the same offense level, an offense level 32, and the drug amounts should have been the same for Billy Taylor and my client, Brad Taylor, or Billy Moss. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Eberhardt?
The please the court, counsel, Steve Eberhardt on behalf of William Moss. Your honors, I just wanted to bring up to the court or remind the court that I believe and I submit that the tide is changing, but unfortunately a change in the law usually only happens with about glacial speed. When you look at the bottom line of what the Supreme Court has decided, I realize and I have to admit that the issue has not been directly addressed by the United States Supreme Court, but I want to point to this court to the to page 4 in our reply brief, the quote from Justice Scalia in his concurrence in Ring versus Arizona, where he talks about the fundamental meaning of the jury trial guarantee of the Sixth Amendment is that all facts essential to the imposition of the level of punishment that the defendant receives, whether the statute calls them elements of the offense, sentencing factors, or Mary Jane, must be found by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, maybe I'm looking at this over-optimistically, but level of punishment sure sounds to me like offense level in the sentencing guidelines. There's no problem with the judge, once you determine an offense level, going in and saying, well, it's going to be 110 months, it's going to be 120 months, or something like that. But when you go from a low offense level to a high, based on what the government wants to call relevant conduct at this point, I think it has to be done by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And I hope this, maybe I'll be back here 5 years later and I'll be right and other people have been wrong. So I just ask you guys to change it at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. Norwood.
And may it please the court, my name is George Norwood. With respect to the last argument, the government believes that Apprendi is pretty clear that unless a factor increases the defendant's sentence above the statutory maximum, then the district court is free to apply the fact-finding and standards it used prior to Apprendi to determine the defendant's relevant conduct, any enhancements for obstruction of justice, role in the offense, etc.
Now, of course, that's been true, but you would agree, would you not, Mr. Norwood, that this has been an area of the law in which the Supreme Court has been quite active since it decided Apprendi. We have Ring, we have Harris, we have other cases coming down the pike, and certainly the volume of litigation in the lower courts has been phenomenal, so that's on the one hand. Then on the other hand are decisions from courts like this one that have chastised defense counsel for not making Apprendi-like arguments as early as 1992 when every court in the country would have laughed them out of the room. So surely it's a reasonable position to argue that perhaps defense level and the guideline structure need to be part of the jury process.
And it's not only reasonable, but I think prudent for defense counsel to raise the argument. I just think the law has established to this point that the argument is not successful. Whether the Supreme Court ultimately changes that is up to the Supreme Court, but at this point in time, the argument does not have merit in this court. With respect to the argument regarding jailhouse informants, first of all, the defendant never raised this issue, defendant Brad Taylor never raised this issue before the trial court in any way whatsoever. The government can't recall any evidence that the defendant was brought to court with other defendants, other than maybe the defendant saying it to the court when he wasn't even under oath. But it doesn't matter. The defendant was in a county jail. The defendant was talking about his case to other people who were from the same town as he was and who he had known before he even went into pretrial custody. The defendant was making admissions about his case. The defendant was admitting, for example, that he took the confidential source over to Eric Moss's house on the day of the purchase. All these statements are legitimate inquiries by the government on direct examination. There was no evidence. First of all, there was no evidence even before the district court that any of this was improper. There's no evidence that the government went to these defendants and said, went to the witnesses and said, go to Brad Taylor, find out what he's talking about his case. I think it's routine practice for all prosecutors to ask, has the defendant made any statements while he's in jail? But the government did not tell these witnesses to elicit any statement from Brad Taylor. There's no evidence of that, period.
Would it be your position that if the standard of review is plain error, that people are automatically not entitled to an evidentiary hearing?
If the standard is plain error?
Right. I mean, your argument is that he never raised this before the district court, therefore that means it's a forfeited claim. We can review forfeited claims for plain error, and thus there's a set of standards that we use. Now, as I understood the argument from your opponents, the idea is that we need to explore further the circumstances under which, or at least one of the ideas, we need to explore the circumstances under which these conversations took place, whether there was any agency, whether there's anything going on. But I'm understanding you to say that when you don't raise it at all before the district court, you're not entitled to that kind of exploration.
The government does not believe it's necessary in this case. No, under a plain error analysis, clearly the claim cannot prevail. Even under any standard review, their claim can't prevail. If this court were to even assume a harmless error analysis to this, assume they were government agents, and the government is not conceding that point, but even assume there were witnesses after witnesses after witnesses that described this defendant's role, Brad Taylor, in the conspiracy. If these statements, there are approximately three statements by these by Brad Taylor to these witnesses, even if they should have been excluded and were improperly included, it's absolutely harmless in this case, given the mountain of evidence against Brad Taylor in this case.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question. What if the one of these multi-defendant cases, one defendant, usually have several that come to the prosecutor, they want to make a deal, and you get a plea agreement with a couple of these folks, and the government, the AUSA, says it's going to be 60 days before the trial, you're going back into jail. You know, keep your eyes and ears open if you hear of anything that you think will help us, let us know. Does that make somebody an agent then?
If the government just say keep your ears and eyes and ears open.
Sure. You know, you're playing ball with us now, so if something... hear something that you think is helpful.
As a hypothetical question, just that the government, in my opinion, would not be enlisting this individual as an agent or trying to deliberately elicit statements, just telling somebody to keep their ears open. I believe in the Moulton case, they actually had wired up the person to go in and get conversation from the person.
That's
totally different.
That's
from
an extreme. I don't know where you draw the line here. I don't think the line is going to be that once there's a plea agreement understanding that person automatically becomes an agent of the government for all purposes when he's in custody.
I believe that's correct.
But is there something short of wiring somebody up and expressly sending them into a cell to engage in conversation and elicit incriminating statements from the defendant? Is there something short of that would qualify as being exactly the government's arm going in there and getting that statement?
The government does not believe that anything short of deliberately eliciting statements, telling the witness who a cooperating individual who is in custody to go to this defendant, talk to that defendant about their case and see if they say something about that case. With all due respect to these defendants, some of them are pretty bright. Some of them know that if they're in custody and they hear information from other defendants that they may use to...
And some aren't so bright if they talk as well.
Exactly. the government would say that there has to be some showing that the government took an active role in deliberately sending a witness in to elicit the statement. That's what the case law suggests. I think in the Lee case, I believe it's spelled L-I, I believe the government may have even had advance notice that the witness said, I'm going to go in there and do this, and I think the government knew that but did not send the person in, just took a hands-off approach, and even that, I believe, this court said it wasn't a deliberate elicitation by the government and the person was not a government agent. So I think the line is pretty a lot higher than just saying keep your ears open. With respect to Randy Moss's argument regarding the grouping and stacking, the government's still a little confused and doesn't fully understand the argument. These are separate crimes. You have a conspiracy charge, which has a maximum, in this case, of 40 years. You have two separate distributions, and you have a felon in possession charge. Sure, the counts, and I believe the counts were grouped together by the probation office for purposes of determining the offense level that was appropriate, but once the offense level is determined, and once that offense level and the possible punishment is determined to be outside the count or higher than the count with the highest statutory maximum, the United States Sentencing Guidelines 5G1.2D, the government submits, strongly suggests, if not dictates, that consecutive sentences be imposed.
But you know, I think their argument is, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the predicate act kind of argument you see in the 848, 846 cases, like Richardson and the like. If the same sale of, I'll just make up a number, you know, 100 grams of crack is the subject of a substantive count, and that's part of your proof of the conspiracy, showing that the parties took acts in furtherance of the conspiracy, and hence we can infer that there really was an agreement to do something. I think they're trying to say that you have that same kind of overlap, and therefore it's inappropriate to sentence on the basis essentially of 200 grams, counting the same 100 grams twice.
But the government does not believe that the probation department or the court is double counting the 100 grams twice in that case. What in that case, if there were a conspiracy to distribute illegal narcotics and there was a 100 gram sale and that was total relevant conduct, total relevant conduct would be 100 grams.
And now there's a substantive count, too, of actual distribution. And you come in and you prove that same sale, you know, on October 28th, 2002.
Yeah. But the relevant conduct would still be the 100 grams if that were all that were all that were issue. When the probation department and the court group,
and you would say that in that hypothetical it doesn't increase the offense statutory maximum then? That you couldn't have
it doesn't, but I'm saying it does not increase the offense level that is calculated by probation. The offense level by probation is the relevant conduct. In the hypothetical you gave, as I understand it, there was an agreement and there was only one distribution
right.
of 100 grams, and
right.
that's the total relevant conduct.
That's count one, and count two is the substantive sale of that 100 grams.
It's the same. Then probation, the relevant conduct in total in determining the offense level would be the 100 grams, not 200 grams.
But how many years can they get for it? Count one, let's assume because of, you know, prior offenses or whatever, has an offense statutory maximum of 40 years. Count two has an offense statutory maximum of 40 years.
Yes.
So could you give the person a 50-year sentence in that instance by partially consecutively running them?
Absolutely. If the
offense level... That's the point. Yeah, I think that's what getting at.
But there are two separate crimes that the defendant is being punished for,
mm-hmm.
even though the offense level... And I believe other circuits, and I'm not sure if this court has directly addressed the issue, but I believe other circuits out there, and I believe they're cited in the brief, have said that based upon Apprendi, and I mean, it gets back to, I suppose, the Apprendi and whether and if it will ever affect the sentencing guidelines. But the other circuits have indicated that consecutive sentences do not offend grouping and stacking and consecutive sentences do not offend Apprendi as long as the sentence is below the offense or the statutory maximum for all the counts as you add them up.
Yeah, this court has said that too.
So, I believe the Magi decision is a pre-Apprendi, but has the same concept where counts were grouped together, then they ran consecutive sentences over two counts. The thing to keep in mind, I mean, the example, well, if there were 1,000 sales of 1 gram each, it's still 1,000 different crimes for which the government first has to prove a defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and then the defendant has to be punished for those crimes. However, the Congress and the Sentencing Commission determine it to be, but once the offense level is determined, the defendant has to be punished according to the guidelines based upon the offense level and criminal history. So, are there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Handelman, how much time?
Total for the side. Jury found Randall Moss guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of 5 grams. That wasn't his sentence. There's nothing in the law which says relevant conduct allows a sentence to exceed, or shouldn't be, allows a sentence to exceed the statutory maximum. What we have here is a tension between the application of Apprendi and the application of 5G1.2D. If Apprendi is going to have any meaning, it has to limit 5G1.2D to the amount involved in the agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Everhart. Mr. Lavelli?
Your Honor, I thank you for the opportunity. I believe I have a minute left. The only comment I'd like to make is I don't believe there would be any discovery because the record should have said something if there was some discovery that the defendant's pretrial statements included these statements to the other co-defendants, and that alone is reason to send this matter back for additional for a hearing, actually. But I must stress that the evidence coming out the way it did in this case just led to an unfair trial, and the reason that the case agent was put on at the very end to say all the things that he did about all of these post-arrest statements and other statements, and even statements of people that didn't appear at the trial, corroborated everything, and the case was so strong, just once again took the case away from the jury and violated the defendant's right to counsel, because you cannot cross-examine these statements. So I don't believe he had notice. I believe the defense lawyer was in a very untenable situation. How can you object to statements that allegedly are coming from your own client's mouth when you're just finding out about them? And then when you don't do it once, you can't do it a second time, because that highlights the fact you didn't object the first time. So it's a very difficult situation to respond to why there were no objections. But I believe the possible answer is it caught the defense lawyer unaware. I don't believe there was any discovery on this point. I could be wrong about that, but the record is silent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Covelli. Mr. Everhart, you didn't save any for a rebuttal, but if you'd like to make some remarks.
No, thank you, Honor.
Thanks to all counsel, and particularly...